Okay, welcome to Discovery 1, Module 3, and we've got a fairly big stuff to go through today, so there you go. Now, a couple of students have been taking the exams for the various module exams, just a general announcement, and they haven't been doing as well as they possibly would have liked, and they'd like to retake the exams, which is fair enough. Now, one of the things that occurs to me about this, however, is that you can keep retaking the exam and retaking the exam and retaking the exam until you get 100%, which will all be very good. Although, what we're more interested to see is how much you actually remember. So we'd ask students if they could to wait a few days, at least 3 or 4 days, possibly even a week, between their retake exam attempts, and we can see how much of the knowledge has dribbled out through your ears in the meantime and how much actually stuck in long-term memory, because otherwise you're just working from short-term memory and you'll get to the final and you won't remember any of it. So, and for the person who I will not identify, yes, I will re-enable your expired assessment today regardless, and then if you don't do too well at that, you can have another shot at the assessment again. I think I've actually set the priorities on this class so that you can do it up to 5 times, but we'd really prefer that people not need five goes at it if they could help it. Basically, you've got to clear 75% on all the chapter exams to pass the exam portion. You've got to clear 75% on the final, and you need to complete all of your labs and worksheets, which are worth 15 marks or something. And I can get the exact breakdowns from the gradebook. Has anybody got any questions or comments on that? I mean, how are people finding the exams and the diagram descriptions and stuff? I know it's a bit of a scrabble in a Word document, but how are people finding it?
This is a really stupid question. That's just, you know, my favourite, but I can see where the labs are and I can see where the exams are, but I'm not sure where the worksheets are.
The labs are in the worksheets folder?
That would make sense. Okay. No, I mean, I know where for the descriptions, I mean, for the actual sheets on the, you know, on
what do you
Netacad.
What I don't understand your question.
Okay, so the worksheets you complete are on QCAD. That would explain it, because I was looking on them on Netacad rather than on QCAD.
Hello, all of the resources that you need except for the exams are on QCAT. QCAT is your one-stop resource shop. We've made that very clear, and that's for everybody. QCAT, people, QCAT. On QCAT are all your exams and labs and worksheets. No, that's okay, but I'll just make it very clear. QCAT is where all the labs and worksheets and stuff are stored. They're on QCAT, everybody. Just one more time, QCAT. Okay, if you listen to the recording, we hope you realise that they're on QCAT. But yes, they're on QCAT, and if you have trouble finding them on QCAT, let us know, but that's where they are. For a cyber lollipop, can anybody tell me where the labs and worksheets are?
QCAT.
Well done!
Did you get the message I just typed into chat?
Do you still have the labs you completed last year?
Last year?
Yeah.
And I marked them, didn't I? I recall marking them.
Yeah. I can send them all back if you want.
No, that'll be fine. Just send the ones you've yet to do back to me, because I'm pretty sure I remember marking them.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, I'll send back from module. I think it's module 6 or 5 on.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. Okay, now we're just tidying up the end bits of module 2. Now, we are going to talk about the stuff that you need to put on a network. The stuff you need to put a computer on the network, you need a network card, you need a TCP/IP stack, you need an IP address, you need a subnet mask, and to talk to the internet, you need a default gateway, okay? So that's an IP address, a subnet mask, and a default gateway. This is in your Chapter 2 test, I believe. Does anyone see that question? I was in the Chapter 3. Yeah, I think there was one in Chapter 2. It's also in Chapter 3. Okay, so you want an IP address, a subnet mask, and a default gateway. You need all three to get on the internet. There's a question that says, you know, which things do you need to connect to the internet? And you've got to tick like three of them or whatever. Okay, the other thing you need is for your computer name. For a Windows machine, you need a host name and a NetBIOS name. Now, does anybody know the difference between a host name and a NetBIOS name? And it's okay if you don't. Would anyone like to have a wild guess? Okay, the silence is deafening. I'll just tell you, I suppose. The host name is how the internet refers to the machine. In other words, what name will go on the received headers and stuff in outgoing emails, and what names the ping command will use if it's using DNS resolution or host-based resolution. And the NetBIOS name is actually the computer name on a Windows network. So that's the one you see in network neighborhood. Now, last week I spoke about it being important to plan the network. I did, didn't I?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure you did.
I'm pretty sure I did too. I talked about all these people that ran in and sort of tried to set everything up straight away without reading any of the documentation and stuff.
A bit like,
Yeah,
the kid that rips the stuff out of the thing, fiddles with the box, then breaks it and then goes looking for the instruction manual when it doesn't work. Don't do that with networking, because you're going to cost your clients money, and you're also going to cost your yourself a lot of reputation. Now, do we have a quiz this morning, Grace?
We do have a quiz.
Oh, okay. Is everybody ready to do the Module 2 quiz? Is everybody ready to do the Module 2 quiz, or are we all asleep this Tuesday night?
Let's go.
This one's really, really short and really, really easy, you guys. Yep, no problem. Just putting on the AutoVox. All right. This is only 5 questions. In comparison, Chapter 3's is 12. Okay, and we all know what we're doing. We get into our chat window. You get into your chat window, and you type in A, B, C, or D, or yes or no, depending on if it's a choose multiple answers question.
And you do not hit enter until we say go. Otherwise, you'll give your friends the answer.
Okay, question 1. A network technician needs to install a new operating system on a computer. In order to preserve the data, applications, and configuration settings, and partition present, which installation method should be used? Is it A, clean install, B, upgrade, C, multi-boot, or D, virtualization? Answer now. And that is absolutely correct. It is an upgrade.
Or E, back all the data up, do a clean install, and shovel all the data on, which is what you're supposed to do anyway.
Yeah. I would have said E.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, because you know how well upgrades usually go, but hey.
Yeah.
Okay, 2. When developing a naming scheme for a network, which 2 pieces of information are most beneficial when determining a computer name? Choose 2.
Oh, we didn't talk about that, but anyway, go ahead.
Oh, well, let's see if I can get it. This is going to be a yes or no. Is it device type? And do you want to type in yes or no after
that? Hang on, how about you go through all of them, and then we'll go back through them again so that they've got an idea of all 4. Yeah.
Okay, so your choices are device type, location, year purchased, operating system, software installed. So we'll go back through, and people can say yes or no to each. All right, the first one is device type, yes or no?
Say the question again, maybe that'll...
The 2 types of information that are required, that are most useful to have in a computer name. I think you'll find that's actually a yes.
Because if you're in a school building or something, you'll want to say computer whatever or printer whatever, so that you know exactly which device type you're referring to when you're sharing a file or sending a file to a printer. How about location? That's absolutely correct. So we don't have to go through the other ones, year purchased or operating system or software installed, because it really doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, because we've got our 2, and we know that the most important pieces of information when accessing or referring to a computer on a network would be its the type of device and the location.
Well, I mean, that depends on how you feel about naming the things. I mean, there are some network administrators that like to name their computers after Lord of the Rings characters. So you've got, like, 600 Gandalfs, 400 Bilbos, 800, you know. You don't have any Galadriels, because nobody can type backslash backslash Galadriel, because it's just too hard to spell. or you've got the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So you've got 27 Marvins, 16 Zaphods, you know, etc., etc. But yeah, there is actually a section in the notes that talks about how you name your computer, and you have like PC1.15, which might mean that it's PC in Lab 1 and it's PC15 in Lab 1 or whatever. So you're trying to embed some information in the actual names of the computers. We didn't really cover that, but I'm pretty sure it was covered in your notes.
Yeah, it is. Okay, on to question 3. What portion of the operating code interacts directly with computer hardware? Is it A, GUI, B, shell, C, kernel, or D, window? Answer now. Awesome, everybody. That's absolutely right. The answer is C, kernel.
And kernel starts with a K, just in case you didn't know that.
Okay, question 4. Which two operating systems issued under the general public license allow end users to modify and enhance code? Choose two.
We'll do a yes, no?
Yes, no, yeah. So, Windows XP, yes or no? No. 100% correct, no. Mac OS X? Yeah, absolutely right. No. How about Linux? Absolutely.
Sorry,
right.
I was being modern with my answer.
BSD? BSD, I'm sorry. Is it?
It is.
Okay.
The BSD license does say you can actually distribute the source code and stuff. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had so many spin-offs like 386 BSD, FreeBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, heaven knows what else BSD. There's all sorts
of
different.
All right. And Unix?
No.
No.
Hello, Twitter.
Yeah, someone's got Quitter running.
I do.
You gonna shut your Quitter down? Well, there's actually, if you're running the newer beta, there's a mute hotkey you can.
Oh yeah, hold on.
Yeah, there is.
There we go. We're muted. Stupid thing. All right, and the last question. This will be a yes or no. Also, what factors need to be considered when choosing an operating system? Choose three.
So we'll yes, no again?
Yep. The operating system has limited availability.
What are our options? Just let us the options.
The operating system supports end user requirements. Sufficient hardware resources are available. Users can support the new software without help. Human resources exist to support the product. The operating system is backward compatible with MS-DOS, and those are your choices.
Okay. There are three that I can pick out there that would actually come through, but people don't feel very confident with that one, do they? Yeah. Which ones have they got marked there, Grace?
They don't have it marked. We get to kind of guess. But I would say that the operating system supports end-user requirements. Sufficient
Definitely.
Hardware resources are available. Human resources exist to support the product. You don't really care if it's compatible
with MS-DOS.
MS-DOS, because, well, unless you do, but you don't know the actual scenario. So those would be the three I'd pick out of the questions.
All Okay, so does everybody understand that? Now that they've had it pointed out to them, you've got to have human resources for, say, people can ring up if they've got problems with the operating system. The operating system has to satisfy the hardware requirements, and the operating system has to do the other thing, which I can't remember.
You need to have compatible hardware, I think it was.
Oh, I said that.
Let's see. The operating support supports the end user's requirements, which is pretty much a no duh. I mean, yeah.
Okay. Any questions on Module 2 before we go on to Module 3?
Can hear your jaw.
Yeah, we could, but that's okay. Okay, there'll be a quiz that'll say whether you pass or fail the module in 20 minutes, and it'll all be on Chapter 2. No, just kidding. Okay, moving on to Chapter 3. And we will be talking about all different sorts of things, such as networks, and what is a network, and how you deal with building networks and that sort of thing. Now, how's everybody going with their lab submissions? If you haven't had your labs marked by me yet, ping me, and I will make sure that I get to your labs today. So if you have unmarked labs, drop me a note, and I'm going to go back through and look myself, but if you drop me a note, that'll make it even more sure that you're going to get your labs marked. Alrighty. Module 3, connecting to the network. Okay, so can anybody tell me what a network is?
It's a bunch of different computers connected together.
I'd go as far as to say a number of different entities that are connected to network. For example, a personal network is just as valid as a computer network. So you can have like a personal network because you know this bloke who knows this other bloke who knows this other bloke that can get you like cheap stuff from the pub. That's a very important personal network if you're into that sort of thing.
Especially at lecture time.
Exactly. Who else can you secretly MSN to try and get the answers to a question? Because it'd be a bit expensive with international SMS otherwise. Okay, so we're going to talk about general networking. There are different sorts of networks. There are, as I said, there are personal networks. Can anybody give me some other examples of technological style of networks?
Your telephone.
A telephone, ring, ring, here's a thing, yep. Somebody other than Scott. Rail network. The cable network, yes. Guys, this is an interactive lecture. Can everyone get involved here? Any more networks?
The internet.
Yes, there is the internet. Taylor's favourite network. Okay, how about mobile phone networks? And the television network. Social network. And then there's the abomination that's Facebook. Yes, radio networks. Okay, so we've got examples of networks.
That was from
networks.
Rachel.
Oh, well done, Rachel. If you ever study Discovery, I'll give you one extra mark for getting that question right. There you go. Now, one of the things we have to talk about here is the convergence of networks. Can anybody tell me what the word convergence means? And not Scott, because he probably knows what the word convergence means, because he was in lecture last year.
It's where multiple items or pieces of technology join together, such as the radio and on a computer, or on a radio being combined with the phone would be convergence of two different technologies at one point being separate.
Oh, I'll accept that answer. Yes, the converge is to come together, as in, you know, to have things that sort of meld into one, if you like. So, for example, has anybody noticed now that there's a whole lot of voice over IP stuff bouncing around the place, and a lot of people are running their phone calls over the internet because it's really, really cheap and nobody wants to spend money?
Yep, I'm doing exactly that.
I can call my sister for 10 cents, but I won't anyway because I don't really want to talk to my sister. But I can, and that's what VoIP is good for. I do want to talk to my sister, by the way, but that's just an example. I'm amazed at how cheap phone calls are these days, and still not many people make them.
Yeah.
People using Skype. You know, how many people who haven't used Skype? I remember when Skype first came out, I believe it was 2002?
Wasn't it? Yeah, 2002 or 2003.
03. It might have been 03. Yes, it was 03. It was towards the end of 03, because I remember Gemma actually registered as Gemma Hoth because she wasn't getting married till 04, and that was all very naughty, but that's how she registered on Skype. And it was actually originally, I don't know whether people are aware of this, but are you aware that the NAT traversal technology inside of Skype actually comes from Kazaa, which is a peer-to-peer file sharing and virus your computer in 5 seconds flat network?
Yeah, yeah, there are a few of those.
Yeah, Kazaa, LimeWire, Nutella, you learn about Morpheus. Morpheus, yes. BearShare, oh, that's a nasty one. I hate BearShare with a passion.
Me too.
BearShare Lite.
It's awful.
It's not actually the client that's the problem. It's the fact that the stuff you get down off at BearShare is often seeded by the movie companies with the most horrible Trojans and evil nasties that will tear your hard drive to pieces before you even get to watch the latest version of Star Trek 11. Okay, so... Okay. Sorry, you were going to say something, Scott?
No, it was just... I pressed the key.
Okay. And of course, none of our students would use any of that sort of technology, would they? So, just so that you know that they're out there, they're peer-to-peer networks. And my genuine advice to you, is if you are going to use these technologies, which of course you won't, make sure that your computer has the most up-to-date antivirus, anti-spyware, and firewall, and that you don't open anything that looks strange, and that you don't mind when the police come and knock on your door and nick all your gear. You'll say, oh well, I was using a file sharing network, it's okay. I just have to make...
when you're trying to run a corporate network either, it's bad times.
It is, and I think I would. I'm going to mention this because a lot of people don't realise this, or at least if they do, they sometimes need it pointed out to them. When you use a file sharing network, you are breaking the law. Okay, you are breaking the law, and that has repercussions if you get caught. And if the DMCA comes and get with a search warrant and nicks all your stuff, you are breaking the law. Now, I honestly know people who didn't realise that. Now, it's a bit of a scary concept, but there are people who honestly didn't realise that they were breaking the law. Also, you are stealing and you are depriving people of their rightful money. Okay, whether that bothers you or not is something that you can worry about.
BitTorrent has some legal stuff on there, like Linux and stuff.
Well, there are legal Linux distributions and stuff on BitTorrent. Yes, there are copyright laws. Now, not that we're talking about this today, but when it says all rights reserved, there are actually 5 rights that are actually reserved. And you can go look them up if you're interested. That's what all rights reserved means. The right to perform, the right to distribute, the right... Anyway, there's a few others, but you can go look those up if you're that interested. So there are copyright laws.
Reminds me of that thing on the news a couple of weeks ago where the guy had bought a copy of a Wii game and a shop a week before it had been sold, and the shop, you know, sold it to him, and then that would have been okay if he hadn't uploaded it onto the internet and let everybody download it, and they find him some amazing amount of money. What was it?
$1.25 million.
Yeah, that's right.
They had an out-of-court settlement with Wii. And because he released it and it got out 3 days before it was supposed to come out, he was in big trouble.
And he was 24?
Yeah, he's going to be very poor.
The rest of his life.
Pretty much. The other thing I would like to point out to you, just so that you know, is if you are connected to a torrent network, your internal IP is published on the trackers and it also bounces around in DHT space. Your ISP keeps a log of when you logged in, which is tied to your internal IP address. If the law enforcement agencies ask your ISP, they will say that you were logged on from that IP at that particular time. So be warned, you are traceable when you torrent. Which, of course, is no problem because we all just download Linux distributions, right? Okay, good.
And podcasts.
And podcasts.
I love my interactive fiction competition.
Absolutely, but I'm just explaining that all to you. That's the legalese out of the way, just so you all know, okay? Because we will, when we see them all take you away, we'll just be like, we'll use you as an example to next year's students. Okay, moving on to the next question, and we hope you never get taken away, by the way. Okay, so we're talking about convergence. So you're dealing with things like voice over IP, you're dealing with streaming the radio station. I mean, how many radio stations have a website now where you just log on to 96fm.com.au if you're in Perth, or mix.com.au if you're in Perth, and you can listen to the radio station? Now, this caused an interesting problem. The tax office in Perth is in a building that is made out of a lot of concrete, and you don't get a very good signal. And there were actually 20 users streaming the cricket, and they actually managed to use up all of the tax office's bandwidth for the month. Okay, does anybody else use voice over IP? Scott uses it, I use it, Grace uses it. Anyone else?
I use it.
This is Rich, I use it.
Yeah, jolly good. Ever notice how you'll be talking along on a voice over IP conversation and it'll sort of go... this sometimes? Obviously
you're too good at that.
Yeah.
It happens every once in a while. It's very rare.
I don't know, fire those torrents up of that free software and you'll find it'll happen more often.
Yeah.
The internet is not guaranteed to give you a certain amount of bandwidth in a certain amount of time. It's basically a best effort delivery system, and if you saturate your network links, your voice over IP calls and stuff can break up, and your Skype can break up and stuff, unless you do take... and VoIP isn't great over wireless if you don't have a good connection between you and the access point. However, if you turn on WMM, which is Windows Multimedia Mode, I think, wireless multimedia extensions, I should say, that makes it a lot better, just in case you wanted to make your wireless VoIP experience a bit better. The other thing you can do is, and a lot of people don't do this because nobody ever went to Skype.com and clicked on help because they just couldn't be bothered, is that if you actually forward the port that Skype is listening on through your router to your workstation, two things will happen. One, you'll get far less call dropouts, and secondly, you will actually sign in within about a half a second rather than signing in about 3 to 5 seconds onto Skype, so it makes your whole Skype experience a lot more seamless.
I heard that you can get better call quality on Skype if you are both you. What the hell is wrong with it? If you both use the same port, is that true? Okay.
Not if you both use the same port. It's if you both forward the port that you both use. If you both forward the port that Skype is listening on through your router, you will actually get a direct connection between you and the other party without relaying through a super node.
Skype However, if your bandwidth too, you're not on the call, doesn't it?
However, if you have bandwidth issues and you don't want it stealing your bandwidth, I was just about to address this, there is actually a registry hack that you can get for Skype called the No Supernode patch, which will stop it from doing this.
Yeah, I must get that.
Okay, now, we're going to talk about the different networks. Has anybody got any questions before I continue?
I was just going to comment that it's also very helpful if you're getting problems with voice over IP to try and configure QoS in your router.
Yes, although interestingly enough, the only thing that QoS can actually control in your router is outbound bandwidth. You cannot shape inbound bandwidth, and there are technical reasons why you can't do that unless you use an intermediate frame block device, which I can assure you that your router does not support, unless you happen to have a Linux box acting as your router like we do. Because if you think about it, you can't shape incoming traffic because by the time you want to shape it, it's already been received by you. And if it's UDP traffic, there's no way to tell the sender to slow down. So if it's TCP traffic, you can slow the acknowledgements down, and that will actually slow the incoming traffic stream down to allow the VoIP through. But if it's not TCP traffic, you can't slow it down. So there you go. But QoS can help on your router. And also social methods of bandwidth control can work as well. Also physical methods of bandwidth control also work well. So say, for example, ripping the cable out of the back of the torrenting computer, or wrapping aluminium foil around its area, will often limit how much bandwidth it can get out.
Physical methods of controlling the bandwidth user.
That's right. As I said, social change. You can encourage them not to use so much bandwidth. It's a setting in your router. You go into your router and you find out whether it's got WMM, and you turn it on, and then you make sure you turn it on in on your wireless cards. And sorry, there are too many different routers and wireless cards, so I can't tell you how to do it on your particular setup. The other thing, though, is don't try and connect to your wireless access point through two brick walls and expect you're going to get a good Skype call, okay? It's just not going to happen. The physics don't work that well. Okay, now, the smallest networks we have are personal area networks. These are networks that are on you or in your personal area or your personal space. Can anybody give me an example of a personal area network? Anybody Anybody at all?
The wireless cards that Verizon and AT&T sell in the US?
No. No.
Bluetooth.
Bluetooth! You've got this phone, and you've got this Bluetooth earpiece stuck in your ear, and the phone's in your pocket, and the Bluetooth earpiece is in your ear. And that is a personal network because it is on you. Okay? Probably another example of personal area network. We probably put infrared into personal area network because the distance isn't that big on infrared. So we're looking at low power technologies such as Bluetooth, infrared, etc. So the personal refers to it that it's on your personal space, not that you're actually a personal user, which is why the AT&T one doesn't qualify. Okay, the next size up from that is a local area network. And a local area network is either a network that is in the same building or in the same geographic location and is under one set of administrative control. So, for example, your classroom network in a school would be a LAN. Your six computers hooked up to play World of Warcraft or Call of Duty is a local area network. And they are usually under one administrative control. Any questions on LAN so far? Obviously, there are people who take the definition of wireless LAN and they stretch it a bit by getting a Pringles tin and some bits of wire and wiring it up to their wireless card and beaming it to their friend 10 kilometres away. We could then probably argue that they are using a wide area network rather than a local area network. That we know people who studied in our courses before who have 25 to 35 kilometre wireless network links stretching across bits of Melbourne. And they work quite well, but I would probably define those as a wide area network. A wide area network being a network that is scattered over a wide geographical area. They usually have higher latency than local area networks, and they're not always under the same sort of administrative control. A MAN is not the bloke who didn't take the bins out last night. It is a metropolitan area network, and we tend to refer to metropolitan area networks as the networks that are installed by the councils and or are controlled by the infrastructure, and it's where they actually put, you know, cables and stuff all around a particular locale and stuff to allow data to travel, or the free Wi-Fi networks that you sometimes get in cities. But I believe there hasn't been too many of those that have actually been successful. They have a business model that doesn't stand up. What is latency? That's a good question. Does anybody know what the word latent means? Yeah, delay. Generally, latency or latent is something that has taken a certain amount of time to happen. So if you've got a, can't think of something with this network here that's latent. So latency is how long it takes for a packet to get from its source to its destination, and that is measured usually in milliseconds, or sometimes it's measured in seconds depending on the sort of networks that you are using. For example, the average, and now keep in mind that latency is how long it takes for the packet to get from its source to its destination. The round trip time is how long it takes for the packet to get from its source to destination and for the packet to get back from its destination to its source. You can check with ping, and provided that the site that you are checking is actually pingable. And if they're running one of those horrible personal firewalls, or they've wound the firewall settings up on their router to I don't receive anything, including web pages mode, you won't get the pings back. In fact, that's something to be careful of. If you do have a firewall on your router, don't wind it up to I don't want to send or receive anything, because you may find that you may have to wind it back down again to actually surf the internet and stuff again. So just be a bit aware of that. And of course, there is the internet. The network of networks. Now, I'll just see if Paul moves down, or whether I've got to drag him down. There we go. The internet is the network of networks. It's the biggest wide area network on the planet. Lots and lots and lots of things all wired up together. Now, if I'm on this lecture and nobody's been on the internet before, I'm resigning, okay? So, let's move on. There are four types of network components. There are hosts, shared peripherals, networking devices, and networking media. Okay, so a host is a particular computer or a network device. a particular computer or a device that has network functionality such as a printer or whatever. It is a device that can send or receive network traffic, and it actually provides services to things on the network. In other words, it hosts services. So, for example, your PC is a host, a network printer is a host, and servers are hosts. I wonder what happened to Scott. A shared peripheral is a peripheral that is shared. Can anybody give me an example of a commonly shared peripheral on a network? Printers.
Hard drive.
I haven't seen scanners shared a lot on the network. It can be done. SANE certainly supports scanner sharing, and with the higher sorts of scanners, but scanners aren't actually shared as often as you'd think.
Hard drive.
Here we go. Yeah, there's storage. You share storage on a network. So, for example, you map network drives and things. There's certainly things that are... And you can actually get NAS drives, which are network-attached storage, which are hard drives that plug into your network. Okay, can anybody give me an example of networking devices?
Routers, switches, hubs.
Yep, routers, switches, hubs, bridges. They are all network devices. And we will get to learn what all of those different devices are. Now, it's probably worth mentioning here that, generally speaking, shared peripherals on the network are shared by the host they are attached to. So, generally, you hook a printer to a server, and you share out the printer from the server, unless it's one of those standalone network printer things with a network card that costs just about as much as the printer does. Okay, can anybody tell me what networking media is?
Ethernet cable.
There's some examples, yeah. Fiber optic cable. It doesn't have to be cables, though, guys. Wireless networks is a valid network media, WLAN, and the media in wireless networks is the air. But yes, networking cables, twisted pair cables, fiber optic, coax, wireless LAN, Bluetooth, which works in the same band, infrared, those sorts of things. Okay, well, now we're going to talk about the network and a bit of role-playing. We're going to talk about the network roles, a client and a server. Can anybody tell me what a server is? Okay, anyone tell me what a server is? I'm not going to talk all... thank you, software that provides services to clients. I'm not going to talk all lecture, guys. I want you guys to talk a bit too. Because I don't like talking all lecture. If I can help it. I'd like you guys to do a bit of involvement, if we can. That's right. Clients... which are the computers that access the server, and the servers share resources, they share devices, they share storage, and in certain instances they can also share processing power if you consider things such as cloud computing. Policemen?
Yes, they serve warrants and things.
Oh, right, okay. Okay, that was just a bit oddball. Okay, but you do have to consider security on servers. You do have to consider security on networks. And you also need to consider, I guess, security for policemen, if that's something that concerns you. Actually, there was an interesting case a number of years ago where there was some evidence for a case in one of the UK... police officers, and they had a whole lot of floppy disks, and they wanted to make a backup copy of this evidence, and they ended up sitting all of the 3.5-inch floppy disks on the fax machine and faxing, doing a photocopy of the front of the disks, and the actual magnetic fields generated by the laser printer actually managed to erase all of the evidence on the disks. Okay, can anybody give me examples of software that would run on, say, clients and servers? So how about some client software? Any examples of client software?
Office.
What a horrible example, Outlook, but yes, I'll give you that one. Outlook should be illegal.
Internet Explorer.
Absolutely.
We have Office, we have Firefox, we have iTunes, although iTunes can work as a server as well. Yeah, I think iTunes... Yeah, so just as you know, iTunes can act as both a client and a server, and it uses... Bonjour, and all that sort of stuff to make itself known. Netscape, you're going back a ways. I'd be saying Thunderbird and Firefox. I don't think Opera is accessible with JAWS, is it? Yeah, it's one of those browsers that like the minority uses, and they go, I use Opera, and you look at them as if they've just, like, I don't know, come from another planet, and you go, yeah, okay, cool. And Safari. Okay. So they're examples of client and server software. So we're looking at things like web servers, web browsers, FTP clients, FTP servers, stuff like that. Winamp is an example of a of client software. It plays MP3s. We have an activity for everybody to do. Isn't this an exciting lecture today? Yay! Grace will just put herself onto AutoVox and we will be doing an exercise on clients, servers, and computer roles. Has anybody got any questions before we do that while Grace turns on her AutoVox? A client is a computer that accesses resources or a device that accesses resources from a server. Please use the definition that is embedded in your notes, your glossary that is embedded in the curriculum, because that will give you what Cisco thinks a client is.
And that's what counts, right? Well,
pretty much.
At this point. okay. We have some scenarios in which we need to decide whether the computer is acting as a client, a server, or both in a peer-to-peer network. So, looks like Armando, you're first. No, let's go to the end of the list and pick on the people at the end of the list, because we did it the other way last time. So that'd be Taylor. Okay. Trishna connects to the internet and downloads a file from a site using a protocol called File Transfer Protocol. Is her computer acting as a client, server, or both?
Client.
Absolutely right. Okay. I think that'd be Stacy. Yeah, you can if you want. Okay, Juan connects to an e-learning website to learn about networking. Is Juan's computer acting as a client, server, or both?
No,
that's only a client. It's receiving information from the website. And the website's going to be acting as a server.
Okay, now it's Rich.
Rich, okay. Noriko has a dedicated computer used for sharing her files. Carlos is downloading a folder from Noriko's computer.
They're pirates.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, hey, it could be. Carlos could be a student. He could be, collaborating with her on a project, you know?
Oh, this is true.
So, Rich, is Noriko's computer acting as a client or a server? Or both?
Server.
That's right. For Randy, how can you tell us about Carlos's computer? What is that going to be acting as? Absolutely. Okay, and the last one goes to Paul. Patty has a video game loaded on her computer. Donald has the same video game loaded on his computer. They're playing each other over a network. Is Donald's computer acting as a client, server, or both?
Probably
that
both.
Could be both, because they're going over a peer-to-peer network and not over the internet, so that would probably be both. And seriously, why can't these people have better names?
Yeah, like Bob and Bill and Sam and stuff. We could just rename them. I think it's meant to give you sort of an international flavor to show you that the Academy
is... Yeah, I think it is too, but they're just terrible to try and read.
Okay. Now, when we talk about peer-to-peer clients, peer-to-peer networks, they are computers that act as both clients and servers. And it is worth noticing that if your computer is acting as a client and a server, it can affect the speed of your computer. So situations such as, how come my machine goes so incredibly slowly whenever somebody prints through it, is a common peer-to-peer network problem, okay? So you might get complaints from the secretary if she happens to have the computer hooked up to the printer and everybody is dumping 100 meg print jobs through her computer. Okay, any questions on any of that before we continue? We are at the halfway point of the lecture. Woohoo! Now, one of the other questions that came up was, and in fact, a couple of users had asked us to whether they had to do the peer-to-peer lab. Yes. It's probably the best lab in the entire course. In fact, if you learn nothing out of this course, the peer-to-peer lab will teach you something. If you want to do the peer-to-peer lab, and even if you only have wireless, you can use two different operating systems, XP, Vista, Windows 7, and you can simulate disconnecting the network cable by disabling your wireless network card. So there's a way of you doing your peer-to-peer network. And I would strongly recommend that everybody do the peer-to-peer lab talk because it's about the most useful lab in the whole course. If you have concerns about doing the peer-to-peer lab, or you don't think you're going to be able to get the gear together, or you honestly can't afford to go down to like Radio Shack or whatever and buy a crossover cable for your two computers because your guide dog will get thinner, we do understand and we will try and find you ways of working around that, but we would like everybody to do the peer-to-peer lab. The other way you can do it is, if you feel adventurous, is to use VMware and actually fire up a couple of virtual machines and disconnect and reconnect the local network cards on the virtual machines so you can run a couple of virtual XP machines on your computer and use those for the peer-to-peer lab, although that is a bit adventurous. But if anybody wants to do that, we can give you the password to the virtual machines area.
So we went to connect the computers to each other or go through a router?
Connect them to each other with a crossover cable. Or cable them to a router. You probably could get away with cabling them to a router. Okay, now I'm going to talk about physical topology diagrams, which are the diagrams of how you physically lay out the network. And there's a whole stack of different symbols that show what the networking devices look like. They're a bit like the electrical symbols, except they're not world standard, like the electrical symbols are. And we actually had some plastic versions of the symbols which won't help the remote students at all. And it actually shows you what a router looks like and what a switch looks like and what a bridge looks like if you're looking at network diagrams. But they do have little icons for the symbols, and I believe the icons are actually described in the diagram descriptions. And the difference between the logical and the physical topology is the physical topology is how everything is actually laid out, in other words, how it's physically wired out and all those sorts of things, and the logical topology is how the actual packets travel, which may not be the same as how devices are physically laid out. Okay, for a message to be sent, for a message to travel on a network, it must have three things. It must have a source, a channel, and a destination. So if we're dealing with an Ethernet network and you're talking from one workstation to another, one workstation is the source, the network media is the channel, and the other workstation is the destination. Does anybody have a problem with that concept? Surely good. Now, the next thing we have to discuss is protocol. Can anybody tell me what a protocol is, or what protocol is in general terms?
General language in which all the computers speak to each other?
Yes, although I'd say a set of rules that govern communication. And for example, you have protocols, for example, answering the phone. Like when you get a phone call, the phone rings and you answer it. And depending on where you are, you answer it in a different way. For example, if you're in Europe and stuff, you'll tend to answer the phone and give your name. And often in Australia, you'll answer the phone and give your name. And you may give the household reason. You might say, Smith House, Bob speaking. It just depends. And it's interesting to see that that is done differently across different bits of the world. But they are rules for how you answer and talk on the phone. And generally it is accepted protocol that when the phone rings, the person gets to answer it and say something, and then the conversation starts, and then the conversation continues, and at the end of the conversation you give your wind-up salutations and you then hang up the phone, and that's how the conversation ends, unless it's one of those conversations where one user slams the phone down and we see that as an unexpected disconnect. Protocols are specific to a medium. So if you've got protocols that run on Ethernet cables, they would be different to protocols that run on wireless links, which would be different to protocols that run on infrared links. So you have the IEEE, which is the Industry of Electronic and Electrical Engineers, and they have a whole lot of different protocols, such as the 802.x series of protocols, such as 802.2, 802.3, 802.5, all those sorts of different protocols. And each of those different protocols deals with a different aspect of networking. So 802.11b is 11 megabit wireless, 802.11g is 54 megabit wireless, etc., etc. If you are going to send a message on the network, you have to do a certain number of things to it. You have to encode the message, you have to format the message correctly, encapsulate the message, which I'll talk about in a minute, and you often have to break the message down into smaller size chunks before it is sent over the network. So, now we get to talk about some of the nitty-gritties of networks where it gets a bit complicated. For a protocol to work, you must go through all of the different stages of sending stuff onto a network. So say, for example, we're dealing with an Ethernet network. An Ethernet network tends to break frames down into units that are no longer than 1,536 bytes, unless, of course, you're using jumbo frames. And if you are, and it breaks, you get to keep both pieces. The network is the network has a source address, it has a destination address, and your communication is broken into frames. It is then sent over the network, the frames are then reconstructed, and the message is received on the receiving station. So, and we do actually get to talk about the OSI reference model, but I don't know whether it's in this chapter or not. So, for example, you start off with, say, an email message. You type a message to your friend. The email software takes that message. It converts it into bits and bytes. It then uses the SMTP protocol to transfer that to another computer, so it breaks the thing into multiple chunks. It then sends it through using SMTP. It's sent from one mail server to the other, and then the other mail server delivers it to the remote computer, and it's decapsulated on the other end and received by the other user's mail client. Does anybody have any questions on that so far? And we will talk about that more. Okay. Now we get into some heavy stuff. We get into what we call the timing and the access methods. And we need to talk about this because it will allow you to understand how Ethernet functions. So guys, chapter 3 is where we really start getting into the heavy stuff. 1 and 2 sort of eased you into it. We are now up to our necks in molasses. So here we go. Which is very sticky and messy. When Ethernet was being developed in the early 70s, it was developed in such a way they were modeling Ethernet's development on a set of radio networks which were on the Hawaiian Islands. So if you needed to radio somebody and ask them if they had any more pineapples, and interestingly enough, they don't grow pineapple in Hawaii anymore. But interestingly enough, you would then use the... you would listen for silence, and you would then transmit on the radio network to get your message through, and provided that nobody else was transmitting at the same time, you would get your message through. If somebody was transmitting at the same time as you were, that was called a collision. You would then have to stop and wait for the line to be quiet so that you could transmit again. Now, this isn't very efficient, or at least it wasn't on the Aloha network, because as we know, radio transmitters and receivers are only half duplex. Now, this is interesting. We should probably define a couple of terms here. Simplex half duplex and full duplex. Can anybody tell me what simplex is? One direction only. So, for example, you're looking at things like television broadcasts, radio broadcasts, those sorts of things. Can anybody give me an example of what half duplex is? Okay, half duplex is where you can only either send or receive a message at any one time. You can either be sending or you can be receiving. And in some half duplex system, the turnaround delays are quite high, so it actually costs you a fair bit to actually stop sending and start receiving, or vice versa. And you can only be either sending or receiving at any given time. Now, full duplex is where you could be sending and receiving at the same time. So there you see your simplex, your half duplex, and your full duplex. Okay, so say we are dealing with Ethernet, and it uses a system which is similar to this Aloha network that was used on the Hawaiian Islands in 1973, and I think it was a guy called Bob Metcalf that actually did the research at Xerox Labs to get Ethernet up and running. It uses a thing called CSMACD, and you will eventually have to know what this acronym stands for. It stands for Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Detection. And I will go through each of those parts of that acronym so that you understand what it actually means. Let's say, for example, we are sitting Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Detection. Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Detection. I'll be saying it a lot throughout the course, believe me. Now, this is covered in your notes, and I would strongly recommend that you read Chapter 3's notes to get the exact lowdown on this, and I would strongly recommend that people look up CSMA/CD in the glossary, if possible. And it's probably a good idea, if you're starting to come across a lot of new terms and stuff, that you make your own little glossary that you can refer to, so that as you learn the jargon, you will know the terms.
But we are lucky, because before we didn't have access to our glossary, and now we do, so at least you have that.
Yes, and the glossary is an excellent resource that we do actually have access to, and it works quite well with JAWS and whatever other assistive technology that we're using. Okay, now let's say, for example, you are sitting at a dinner party, and there's a whole lot of people sitting around the table, and you're all having an orderly conversation, one orderly conversation. The protocol is that you listen for silence, and you then start talking. If somebody starts talking at the same time as you, you stop talking and you both wait a polite amount of time, and then you start talking again. And hopefully you don't collide with the other person that was going to talk. I remember being a kid, and they used to say, well, you have to wait for a gap in conversation so that you could say, excuse me, to get your parents' attention or whatever. The only problem with my mother was that there was never a gap in conversation, so you just sort of had to, you know, force a collision, otherwise you'd never get listened to. But essentially, you end up with these stations waiting, and they listen for silence on the line before they transmit. This is the carrier sense. The multiple access means that multiple stations are sharing the same piece of networking media. So if you are using a coaxial network segment, or you are using twisted pair cables on a hub, everybody is sharing the same network segment. They're not sharing the same network segment if you're using a switch, and we'll talk about that later on in discovery. So multiple access with collision detection, which means that if two hosts are transmitting at the same time, often you will see an increased voltage on the line, and that will be detected as a collision. When a collision occurs, a jamming signal is sent out so that all hosts know that there have been that there has been a collision, and then you then wait a random amount of time, and it's called an exponential back-off algorithm. So you back off by a random amount of time, and then if you collide again, you back off by an exponentially increasing amount of time, and if you fail to send a packet 16 times on the network medium, the packet is discarded at the link level. Anybody have any questions on that so far? And good morning to Curtis, who's just materialized in the lecture theatre.
Good morning.
Okay. Now, the other thing in networks is you have to have some form of flow control. And flow control is the process of controlling how fast the data is sent from the source to the destination, and it's a method of being able to slow that data transfer down or halt that data. Now, flow control is necessary if machines are receiving data too fast and they can't handle the data, so therefore they drop the packets, or it's useful if you need to control the speed at which data is sent and received. Now, there are a number of methods of flow control, and generally the flow control is handled by higher level protocols. So TCP is responsible for the flow control on how fast traffic is being sent. Has anybody ever wondered that you can access a really, really high-speed web server, whether you're accessing that on a high-speed DSL connection or whether you are accessing that on a dial-up connection, there is flow control in place that allows that data to transfer at the right speed and stops your large server from swamping you with data from the web server on your low-speed connection. Now, flow control is important, and it's often used by people. For example, if you're trying to hand somebody a whole stack of items and they're like, hang on, I've got my hands full, that is a method of flow control. They have asked you to stop handing them items. Okay, any questions on flow control so far? Okie dokie. Now, the other thing that can happen is a timeout. Can anybody tell me what a timeout is? No, it is not the bar made by Cadbury Chocolate. Can anybody tell me what a timeout is?
It's when something you send a packet to takes too long to respond.
Yeah, you send a packet to something and whatever it is wasn't ready to accept or doesn't respond. And it doesn't respond to that time in, obviously, a given time period. And that causes a timeout. And the timeouts... what does a timeout often result in? If you actually see a timeout, what often happens?
Something disconnects.
It can disconnect, but what usually happens before the disconnect happens? Yeah, you can lose a packet. But would it be fair to say that if the transmitter does not see a response to its packet in a certain predefined time period, it tends to retransmit that packet again in the hopes that the next packet will actually get a response? And when you're using TCP/IP, which a lot of us are, the retransmit algorithm has an exponential backoff. So, for example, the first retry will wait a quarter of a second, the next retry will wait a half a second, the next retry after that will wait a second, the next retry after that will wait 2 seconds, 4 seconds, etc. Okay, any questions on any of that before we move on? Any comments? Anything anybody would like to add? Alrighty. Okay, now, when we had original protocols and stuff, they were all made by proprietary people, and IBM had their protocols, and DEC had their protocols, and all that sort of stuff. The problem with that was that if you had IBM gear, you could use IBM protocols, and if you had Apple gear, you could use Apple protocols, and nobody really shared a lot. And this caused a problem with the interoperability of devices and things from different vendors. So what actually happened was that the OSI was one of the groups that was responsible for trying to make this happen, the Open Systems Interconnect. It was in manufacturers' advantage to actually open up the protocols and actually share information between different vendors and stuff so that all different vendors' equipment could interoperate. And as a matter of course, can anybody tell me the most common protocol in use today?
TCP/IP.
TCP/IP. And which stands for Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol. And a couple of you, and I will mention this in Lecture 3 again because I haven't actually mentioned it yet, if you are interested in a copy of the TCP/IP book, which is up on our website, you need to send Cavi Instructors a message saying that you are interested in the TCP/IP book and that you will not distribute it to anyone else. I will warn you, however, that it is a whopping big PDF. So if you have trouble accessing whopping big PDFs, perhaps this TCP/IP book is not for you. And no, you can't QWERTZFile it because we don't have the print password. So you'll basically have to deal with it. It does actually read quite well in Acrobat, but it is a very big PDF file. The TCP/IP book is not required to complete this course. You do not need the TCP/IP book to complete the course. The other option, of course, is if you don't mind skimming over a couple of ads, you can read the TCP/IP guide online. Google for TCP/IP guide, and there's actually an online version of it with a few ads and stuff. Okay, so there are different working groups for the IEEE, as we spoke about, and they are usually given a code, for example 802.1, 802.2, 802.5. So for example 802.5 is token ring, 802.2 is the physical aspects of Ethernet, and 802.3 are the logical framing sections of Ethernet. 802.11 is wireless, and then you have a subcode that defines the different wireless codes, A, B, G, and N, or B, A, N, G. So if your wireless does all of them, you've got bang wireless.
Does anyone still use A and B?
What about A and B?
Are they still used?
Yes, they are. Some PDAs only have B wireless. B also tends to travel better over long distances. And A operates up on the 5.8 gigahertz band, which means it doesn't get knocked out by your mobile phone, etc. There we go, I was just crunching a mouthful of yummy lolly snake. So I didn't think you guys needed to hear all of that. Now, each individual Ethernet device has a MAC address. And a MAC address is a Media Access Control Address, MAC. Can anybody tell me, in bits, if you already know, how long is a MAC address? No, sadly no, but good guess.
64.
No. A MAC address is 48 bits long. 48 bits long. So an IPv4 address is 32 bits. A MAC address is 48 bits. A MAC address is 48 bits. This is in your
like
test.
Tons of your tests.
A MAC address is 48 bits. It's in tons of your tests. Now, if it's 48 bits long, can anybody tell me how many bytes in a MAC address? We have one answer of 6. Anybody else want to have a go? I'm not telling you whether it's right or wrong yet. That's right, 6 bytes long, because there are 8 bits in a byte, and 6 eights are 48. Otherwise, whoever's been writing the times tables sheet has been lying to me for lots of years. Okay, so MAC addresses are usually written as... There are a number of ways of writing MAC addresses. The most common way of writing MAC addresses is 6 double-digit hex numbers separated by colons. So, for example, you have 00 colon 1B colon 1D colon... 28 colon 36. Is that enough of them? Hang on. No, I need another one. So 6 of them. So 00 colon AA colon 00 colon C4 colon D5 colon A1. So 6 two-digit hex numbers separated by colons. The other way you can write them is you can write them as 3 pairs of 4-digit hex numbers separated by dots or colons. So you go 00AA colon 00 C4 colon D1A5. That's another way of writing them. They can either be colon delimited or they can be full stop delimited. However, if you only had a MAC address that had hex numbers that didn't contain any letters, it is possible that you could confuse it with a miswritten Ethernet address, which would then result in a miswritten IP address. So that's basically how those are written. Now, the first 3 bytes of a MAC address are the organizational unique identifier. So the first three bytes of the MAC address are the OUI, or the Organizational Unique Identifier. And they are actually, they tell you who makes the piece of networking hardware that is actually using this particular MAC address. And some organizations have one unique identifier, and some like 3Com and Intel and stuff have quite a number of them. And I would like students to have a look around, have a Google, and see if they can find a list of OUIs, or unique organizational identifiers, on the net. And there is one. And for extra points, if somebody can tell me who owns the organizational unique identifier of 00:AA:00. That's your little assignment for next week. So 00:AA:00. We want to know who owns that. Alrighty. Any questions on that stuff so far?
What are the last three? The machine
identifier? They are just assigned by the manufacturer of the device itself, and they are to make sure that the device is considered unique in that manufacturer's OUI space. Now, generally speaking, each network card should have a unique MAC address, okay? And the MAC address is usually burned into an EEPROM on the network card, and it is very difficult, if not impossible, to change the MAC address on a card, unless you get these really cheap Taiwanese network cards where you can actually set the MAC address in the setup utility. And this is not a good idea, because if you get a MAC address collision on a network, and two machines using the same MAC address, you can have all sorts of funny, very difficult to track down network problems. So don't change the MAC address unless you have an incredibly good reason to do so. Now, the other thing they want us to mention in this lecture is ipconfig/all. Can anybody tell me what ipconfig/all would do?
It lists... I believe it lists the MAC address of your network card, as well current gateway, your IP address, your cell, all useful info.
ipconfig/all, yes. It actually dumps the configuration of all network devices in your computer, and it is able to dump all that information out. Now, I'll give you all a hint for one of the labs that you have to do, because there is actually a lab where you need to give me some pieces of information from your ipconfig/all. Now, DOS users will find this a bit boring, but we are going to use... Now, ipconfig /all should be run from a command prompt. To get to a command prompt, you can either go start programs accessories command prompt, if you're in one of the older Windows, or you can go Windows R and go CMD. And once you have your command prompt open and you are in a you CD to a directory that you want to be in, you can then actually run a command that will actually run the ipconfig command, and it will redirect it into a text file. And I'll just type that command into the chat window.
Oh, and helpful hint, don't just paste in the entire thing to the... Don't just paste the entire dump into your lab and expect us to go through it and decide that, yeah, you know what the MAC address and IP address are. You'll want to actually specify the MAC address is this, the IP address is this, and the lease is this and this.
Your ability to dump the IP...
That doesn't work in the command prompt.
Yes, it does.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You copy the text you want to paste into the command prompt, and then you go alt space, and then you arrow down until you get to edit, and then you go paste. Voila.
Ooh. So it's control V that doesn't work.
No, control V won't work. In fact, you shouldn't be pasting into the command prompt anyway. You should be typing the commands, because you won't learn anything if you just copy and paste the commands. Okay, so that command, because the punctuation didn't talk too well in the chat window, was ipconfig /all > > which is shift in the full stop, which is the crocodile facing to the left, myfile.txt. And that will create a file, funnily enough, called myfile.txt, which can then be opened in Notepad and perused at your lecture. Leisure, even. Or at your lecture. Obviously, if you're using JAWS and the stuff scrolls off the top of the screen, it's a bit of a tight pain to scroll back and actually read that text. So if you redirect the output into a file, it will be easier for you to get your hands on. Take note of what directory you are in when you open the command prompt, however, because when you run that ipconfig space slash all space greater than myfile.txt, myfile.txt will be written in the directory that you are currently sitting in. And by default, when you open a command prompt, that directory is generally your user's home directory. So if you're running Windows XP or whatever, C documents and settings username. Or if you're running Windows 7, it'll be C users whatever. If you want the file to turn up into your desktop, you want a CD space desktop first. And then that way, when you create the file, the text file will turn up on your desktop.
Can you type in a path, or does it just have to be the file?
You can type in a path. I'm actually tempted to stop there, because all the stuff then gets on to structure of IP addresses, hierarchical network design, and all sorts of anything. Is everybody had enough? We're 20 minutes from the end, but I don't really want to go into too many more things from this point.
Not good to fry somebody's brain, you know.
I can go either way.
Yeah, okay. Anybody got any questions or issues or anything raised from today's lecture? And I'm morbid curious, have people found this lecture a bit more full on than the previous ones?
I'm learning more.
Actually, there are three more things I need to define before I disappear, and I managed to skip over these. Unicast, multicast, and broadcast are in the notes. Okay, now a unicast packet is a packet that is sent from one workstation directly to another. Uni being one, as in those guys that run along on those little one-wheeled bikes called unicycles. So unicast. A broadcast is a packet that is sent to all stations on a network segment. And they are often sent out, for example, to do name resolution updates and all sorts of other nifty things. Think of it as shouting into a room full of people. That is a broadcast. And then multicast is a packet that is sent out to a whole stack of machines that are listening on the multicast IP addresses, and it's a little bit complex to cover in this course, so feel free to look it up on Wikipedia. Data storms are covered next week. Alright, well, I think we'll stop there for today. And we will cover things like broadcast storms, broadcast radiations, switches, routers, hubs, types of IP addresses, broadcast domains, and all of that sort of fun stuff next week. Anybody got any questions about anything we covered this week before I close down? Alrighty. We'll be on Skype. Have a good week, everyone.
See everybody tomorrow if you're in my ITE1 class to finish up our Module 2 and start Module 3.